And we're continuing our study through the scriptures here in the book of Genesis, and some really good stuff tonight. Some great examples. You know, the Old Testament is given to us as an example. You know, some people, you know, I think I remember telling you guys not that long ago, last time I went in for an eye exam, I just happened to fall into a conversation with the doctor, and he asked, you know, what I did, and I told him, you know, I was a teacher and pastor, and I kind of began to explain a little bit about how we teach through the whole Bible at Calvary Chapel, you know, Old Testament, New, and he goes, oh, I never read the Old Testament. And I was trying to just kind of communicate with him and just kind of say, well, you know, I can understand why that is the case. Some people find it kind of challenging to kind of hang with, particularly some of those books like Job and others. But I really believe that there is such a powerful and glorious wealth of information, insight, and understanding that we get from the Old Testament. And I just think it's the coolest thing. The neatest thing, though, about the Old Testament is finding the thread of consistency that runs into the New Testament and then gives us a greater sense of dimension and clarity in understanding the New Testament and God's redemptive program that was laid down for the people of earth, starting with his revelation to the people of Israel. And so it really is very cool. I've always so appreciated the Old Testament, and the more I've taught through it, the greater that appreciation grows. No less here in Genesis, beginning in chapter 28. Let me just remind you very quickly that in the previous two chapters that we studied, we dealt with this whole issue of Jacob and Esau, the sons of Isaac, the twin sons of Isaac, and their competition, and how Jacob deceived his brother Esau and stole the birthright, the family blessing. Now, we say stole, but we know that it was God who chose Jacob even before he was born to carry on the Abrahamic covenant that had been given to Abraham and all of his sons to come. Jacob was in line to receive that, even though he was the second born of those two. And yet he felt the need to deceive his brother along with his mother, who concocted the plan, and run away with that blessing. You'll remember that after that happened, Esau was so enraged with what his brother had done, he comforted himself, the Bible says, with the idea that, well, it's not going to be that long before our father dies, and then I'm going to kill my brother. And so he literally prepared to take his brother's life. When Rebekah, their mother, heard this kind of through the grapevine, she went to Jacob and said, listen, you need to get out of here. You need to run for your life. And I want you to go live with my brother Laban back in Padan Aram. And I want you to stay there until your brother's anger cools. And then you can come back home. Little did she know at the time that he would be gone 20 years. And Jacob and his mother Rebekah would never see one another again. Anyway, it's pretty amazing story, and where we pick it up here in chapter 28 is Jacob getting set to leave. And it says in verse 1, so Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him and commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Padan Aram, to the house of your mother's father, who is Bethuel, who was certainly dead by that time. But still, that's, you know, the house that he directs him to. And he tells him, take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Now, Padan Aram probably means the field of Aram, and it became essentially the title of that area for what you and I would refer to as the land of Syria. The journey for Jacob would be about 500 miles. It would probably take him weeks to complete it. And he was told by his father that once there, he should take a wife from among his relatives. He was told not to take a wife from the Canaanites. Why? Because the Canaanites were living on borrowed time. Even though Abraham had been given the land, and Isaac given the land, and of course Jacob given the land was not theirs yet to possess. The Canaanites still lived in the land, and it wouldn't be for several hundred years before the nation of Israel would come back to the land under the leadership of Moses and repatriate the land by removing the Canaanite inhabitants. You'll remember that God gave the Canaanites time to repent of their ways. They were unwilling. And so eventually, under Moses, they came in to, well, and eventually Joshua, they came in to basically destroy the Canaanites and take up the land. But at this time, the Canaanites were living in the land. They were a people for whom God, I guess I need to think about how to put this, whom God graciously gave opportunities, time and opportunity, to turn from their ways. But these people were not going to turn from their ways. And of course, God knew that, even though he was giving them time. And he knew that his people would come in and would possess that land at the expense of the Canaanites one day. And it was important, therefore, that the sons of Isaac not marry from among the Canaanites. But you'll remember Esau already had. He had already taken two Hittite wives, and they were a great pain in the neck, for lack of a better term, for Rebekah and Isaac. We're going to see how he kind of deals with that here in a little bit. But you know, when I stop and think about this, do you remember how Isaac got a wife? Isaac himself got a wife because his father Abraham took time to think it through and decide, my son should not marry from the Canaanites. And so you'll remember he sent his servant to the very same area in Syria to find a wife from his relatives, from among his relatives there. And Abraham took that opportunity, took that effort to plan ahead and get a wife for his son. Isaac, we just don't see that kind of diligence and preparation and planning in Isaac's life. We just don't. And it's kind of too bad. Because toward the end of Isaac's life, we see a man who kind of slacks off from the things of the Lord. We see a man who is willing to give the family blessing to his favorite son, even though that's not God's choice. We see a man who bases his favoritism given to Esau on the fact that Esau is a man of the outdoors, a hunter, and Isaac just kind of liked that. And we see a man who grew, I know it's a little subjective here in terms of what I'm suggesting, but it appears that Isaac grew a little lax in the things of the Lord. Now, he realized, as we brought out last week, that God had his way, and Jacob did end up getting the blessing. And I think Isaac realized, probably toward the end, I have not been as diligent as I should have been in terms of the preparation of passing along the Abrahamic covenant and blessing to my son. Be that as it may now, he says to his son, be sure you don't take a wife from the Canaanites. Take one from your mother's people and so forth. And he says in verse 3, and this is important, look with me in your Bible there. He says, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and increase your numbers until you become a community of peoples. And may he give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham so that you may take possession of the land where you now live as an alien. The land God gave to Abraham. And then Isaac sent Jacob on his way, and he went to Padan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, who was the mother of Jacob and Esau. Stop there for just a moment. You know what's interesting about this is that this second blessing, if you will, that now Isaac pronounces upon his son Jacob is almost word for word the blessing that he received from his father. It's kind of like we're getting the idea that Jacob has finally come to terms with this whole thing. He's come to terms with the will of God. He's come to terms with the purposes of God. Now, they lived a lot longer than you and I would live in a normal lifespan, but do you know at this time, Jacob was about 75 years old and he had not yet taken a wife. It was long overdue that it should have been done. And even though that age, in our term or reckoning, is probably half that, still, Isaac should have handled this by now. And it was really, and frankly, a gross oversight of Isaac himself. But now he seems to have kind of come to the party, if you will, and he's ready to send Jacob on his way to go find the proper wife. It says in verse 6, now Esau, Jacob's twin brother, learned that Isaac had blessed Jacob and had sent him to Padan Aram to take a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman, which of course Esau had already done twice over, and that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and had gone to Padan Aram. And it says, Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanite women were to his father Isaac, and so he went to Ishmael and married Mahalath, the sister of Nebaioth, the daughter of Ishmael, who, by the way, would have been dead by now, son of Abraham, in addition to the wives he already had. And this is kind of one of those lame attempts, if you will, to kind of try to make things better when there really isn't any making things better anymore. And Esau, I don't know if he just doesn't get it. I mean, I think we've kind of brought out in our earlier studies, he just doesn't get it. But realizing that these Canaanite women are grievous to his parents, he goes in the proper direction toward family, because remember, Ishmael was also a son of Abraham, just like his father Isaac was, but he was not the son through whom the promise of God went. That promise came over through Isaac onto Jacob and so forth. And so it's kind of a lame attempt, you know, to try to reconcile a situation for which he should have been thinking properly in the first place. And unfortunately, two wrongs don't make a right. It doesn't really make it any better. But he's trying now, toward the end of his father's life, to somehow win even more of his father's favor and so forth. And it's kind of sad. And so what he does is he ends up engaging in even greater acts of bigamy. And polygamy, you know, at the time was common. In biblical times, throughout the Bible, polygamy was practiced, quite common. But it was never God's intention for marriage. And one of the things that we're going to see, particularly in the life of Jacob, as he goes on and takes several wives, is we are going to see just exactly the consequences that polygamy brings into a family. We're going to see the infighting. We're going to see the competition. We're going to see the antagonism one toward another among these wives and concubines. And it was never God's intention. God's intention originally was that there would be one man and one woman, and that's the way it is described in the scriptures early on. It is for this reason, we are told in Genesis chapter 2, that a man should leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two should become one flesh. It doesn't say 3, 4, 5, 6, or 10. And I don't care what they say on these reality TV shows about how fun and how exciting and how fulfilling that lifestyle is. I don't care what they say. The fact of the matter is, it's fraught with problems. And you know, what you're seeing on television is a Hollywood spin. What you see in the Bible is the absolute dirty dog truth. And that's one thing I love about the Bible. It doesn't soft pedal or whitewash anything for us to make something, you know, look good or try to make it look good. What we see in the scriptures, when we see polygamy and we really get a chance to look into the lives of those who engaged in it, we see the problems. We see the issues, and they were just, it was a mess, because it was contrary to God's purpose and plan, you know, in life. So, anyway, it says in verse 10 that Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. He's on his way to Syria now, and when he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. Doesn't sound terribly comfortable, but, you know. And we're told that he had a dream in which he saw a stairway. Your Bible may say ladder, resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And there above it stood the Lord. And he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Remember, he's still in that area of the promised land. He hasn't gone outside of what we would call Israel yet. He's only gone about 70 miles. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. And you and I both know that when he talks about the offspring of Jacob, he's ultimately referring to Messiah, who comes in the New Testament and dies for the sins of the world. And that's why God says, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Jesus Christ has blessed all peoples on earth without exception. Notice how God is reiterating the promise given to Abraham and to Isaac and so forth. He says in verse 15, I am with you. And will watch over you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place. And I was not aware of it. And he was afraid. And he said, how awesome is this place. This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. All right, stop there for a moment. Let's talk about this. Interesting, isn't it? This is the very first time that God has appeared to Jacob in his life. God has appeared to Isaac previously. God appeared, obviously, to Abraham on several occasions. First time for Jacob. And he's pretty in awe of the whole thing. And he immediately begins to think he stumbled upon the gateway of heaven. Now, that's not true. You and I know that God is omnipresent, which is a word, a big $64 word that we use to basically mean that God is everywhere present, simultaneously. And there is no one particular place where God, put a train station, for the angels to necessarily make their way to earth. But God is showing Jacob in a dream something that is not literal. In other words, there is not a literal ladder or stairway stretching from in the sense of appearing the way it did here, stretching from heaven to earth, which is why God showed it in a dream. It's a symbolic sort of a thing. By the way, the fact that God showed Jacob this in a dream in no way suggests that all of our dreams are divinely inspired. Boy, you get into a mess going down that road, let me tell you. And believe me, I've heard some incredible descriptions of what people think dreams mean. Because they see in the Bible that there are times that God communicates to man through dreams, and that's absolutely true. The Bible does communicate through dreams. But on the other hand, some dreams are just nothing more than the result of, a little too much pepperoni on your pizza or something. But in this dream, God is showing Jacob something that is very interesting. And I believe that what this symbolizes is God's is basically the activity of heaven, if you will, conveying in no uncertain terms to Jacob and to you and I, for that matter, that God is not passive in his dealings with mankind. You know, there are people, I don't know if you've ever heard the term theistic evolution. Theistic evolution is the idea that God created the world kind of like winding up a toy, and he set it down just to let it kind of go on its own. But after the initial creation, he allowed things to evolve on their own after that point. That's why it's referred to as theistic evolution. It's really the marriage between creationism and evolutionism. But the idea here is being conveyed to Jacob that God is involved. There's activity. If you and I could see in this room right now, spiritually speaking, and I know it sounds a little bit science fiction-ish, but if we could just see for a moment what's going on, what's really going on, we're looking with physical human eyes, and that's all we can see with our senses, or at least the one sense of our sight, But oh, if we could just see what's really going on, what's really happening. Do you guys remember the story of Elisha when he was being hunted by one of the kings in the area at the time when he was prophesying? You can read about it in 2 Kings. Great story. He's literally inside of his tent, you know, kind of taking a siesta, and these kings, this king with all of his army comes and surrounds them, you know. And his servant comes to him and says, "Master, we're surrounded. We're in deep yogurt here. I mean, they're going to rush down the hill at any moment and just wipe us out." And Elisha, I don't think he even gets up. He probably doesn't even open his eyes. And he goes, "Yeah, well, you know, those who are for us are greater than those who are against us." And he prays that his servant would be able to have spiritual eyes to see. And he said, "Now go back and look again." And when his servant looked at the hillside, he saw all this huge angelic host mounted on the hillside there coming against their enemies. And it was just that ability, that spiritual vision to see, you know, to understand, wow, God is not cut off and aloof from what's going on in our lives. He's very much involved. And I think that that is one of the major issues, or one of the major communications that God is making with Jacob, in addition to affirming with him and reaffirming the Abrahamic covenant that was passed along to his grandfather and to his father. But you know, it's kind of a neat thing that he gets to see these angels literally on this stairway or this ladder. If you're thinking of a ladder, don't think of a ladder like you and I would carry on top of a truck. Think of a ladder that's maybe as wide as this room, for example, that angels are ascending and descending simultaneously, you know, climbing on the lattice of this fixture that is extended up into heaven and reaches down to earth and so forth. The one thing that we do know from this dream that Jacob has here that is genuinely true is the fact that God uses angels to accomplish his will upon the earth. I don't think that's because God needs angels. I don't think God needs anything. But he uses angels. And throughout the Bible, we see the activity of angels on many occasions acting as kind of a go-between, if you will, between God and man. Let me show you a couple of passages. Those of you on the internet, you'll click right next to where you see me. But from Hebrews 1:14, it says, "Are not all angels ministering spirits sent?" Why? To serve those who will inherit salvation. There are angels who are literally sent to the earth, if you will, to minister to those who are inheriting salvation. And that's those of us who have accepted Christ as our Savior and so forth. David wrote of angels in the Psalms. Psalm 8 and verses 4 and 5 says, "What is man," he says to God, "what is man that you're even mindful of him, that you even stop to think about him?" He says, "And the son of man that you visit him." This is out of the New King James, by the way. He says, "For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor." Now, this is a reference to mankind. And he says, first of all, "God, I'm absolutely blown away that you would even take notice of us. I mean, what are we but a blip on the eternal radar? I mean, I don't think we're even a blip." You know? He says, "So, first of all, I'm super impressed that you even care. And I mean, what is it that would make you care for us? You made man a little bit lower than the angels. And yet you crowned him with glory and honor. You gave him dominion over the earth. You know? That's what you did for man. It's incredible that you would do such a thing." But angels are then a higher form of life, if you will, at least right now, than mankind. Angels can't die. They're spirit beings. They can apparently move effortlessly, you know, around the world in which you and I live in ways that you and I, you know, could maybe only dream about with something like Star Trek. But even without the you know, benefit of technology, they just simply can go here and there and so forth. And they're amazing. And here's something else that we need to remember. Angels, I don't care what Hollywood says, angels are not human beings who have died. You know, they are completely different. We are completely different from angels. Angels are created by God as angels. Human beings are created by God as human beings, and never the twain shall meet. They are two different. You know, you hear people once in a while saying, well, when somebody dies, they'll say, oh, well, God needed another angel. No, he didn't. God doesn't need anything. And as I said before, if he did, he wouldn't be God. Okay? So, you know, human beings do not become angels, and they don't get their wings every time a bell rings either. So just in case you guys wondered about that one too. But I'll tell you, angels are amazing, but you know, they're servants. They're nothing more. They're servants from God. But I want to go back to this issue of this ladder or this stairway, if I could, for just a moment. Personally, I have to tell you that I really like this image, and I think I always kind of have this image of angels ascending and descending, because it just, again, it speaks of the activity between heaven and earth. But here's a really interesting thing about this picture of angels ascending and descending. Think about where we are in the Old Testament right now in the life of Jacob. We're going to take two steps toward the future, which is going to land us to the time of the public ministry of Jesus Christ, 2,000 years in the future. And this subject is going to come up again. And it comes up in a situation where an individual who had been invited by Jesus to be a follower decided this was too good to keep to himself, and he had to go tell his friend. And it's actually recorded in John chapter 1. Let me put these up on the screen for you so we can look at it together. In John chapter 1, it says, the next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. And finding Philip, he said to him, follow me. And Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. And Philip found Nathanael and told him, hey, we found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nazareth? Can anything good come from there? Nathanael asked, come and see, said Philip, which is a great response, by the way. And when Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. How do you know me? Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Then Nathanael declared, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And Jesus said, you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree. You shall see greater things than that. He then added, I tell you the truth. You shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Now that's fascinating, isn't it? Did you notice that Jesus said, you're going to see some pretty amazing things. Let me just tell you right now. You're impressed because I saw you sitting under the fig tree before you were even called. You know, you got to wonder, what was he doing under the fig tree? I'm just going to guess, okay? And this is a wild guess. So don't go around telling people this is what happened. This is just nothing more than my opinion. I'll bet, though, he was thinking about that very passage we're studying tonight. I'll bet he was. I bet he was thinking about Jacob and that ladder from heaven and the angels of God ascending and descending. I'll just bet you he was. And then along comes Philip and he says, hey, dude, come on. You got to come hear this guy. This guy is really incredible. Jesus of Nazareth. And he's like, Nazareth, give me a break. What good can come out of Nazareth? And I love Philip. He's like, well, come and find out for yourself. Sometimes we think we have to explain everything to everybody. We got to convince them. It's like, hey, just come and check it out, man. I like that. That's neat evangelism. Anyway, so he comes and here Jesus says to him, ah, here's a true Israelite in whom there's nothing false. How do you know me? Well, I saw you even before Philip came and got you. I saw you while you were under the fig tree. I'm impressed. Oh, suddenly Nathanael's impressed. He says, you're him. You're the man. He goes, oh, you're impressed with that? Oh, you'll see far greater things than that. You will see heaven open, and you will see the angels of God ascending and descending, what, on a ladder? No, on the Son of Man. What is Jesus saying here to Nathanael that day? He's saying, I am the way. to heaven. I am the path. I am the ladder. There is only one way to heaven. There is only one mediator between God and man. I am it. I am the ladder. I am the door. I'm the gate. I don't care how many different things you want to apply to it. I'm it. I am the way to heaven, to know God. I am the access of activity from heaven to earth and earth to heaven. I am it. And Jesus is directing and using the language of Genesis to direct the attention to his own person and his own ministry. I just think that's very, very powerful. Let's keep reading. Verse 18, it says, early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head, and he set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. So that's in a way of anointing it. He already felt like it was anointed, so he was going to anoint it himself. And he called that place Bethel, or probably better pronounced Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. I think Bethel was probably an improvement, don't you, over Luz. Luz sounds like a dish soap, you know, doesn't it though? I use Luz, or something like that. Gets the dirt out. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And all that you give me, and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. What's Jacob doing here? He's making a deal with God. You know what this passage tells us, I think, in pretty clear terms? That Jacob really didn't have any kind of a relationship with God. He really didn't even necessarily consider his father's God his own at this point in time. I think Isaac, and again, this is you know, a little bit of, you know, subjection on my part, but I think Isaac had so slacked off as a father that Jacob was just kind of going through life on cruise, and he wasn't reminding his sons of the importance of serving the Lord, walking with God uprightly, and so forth. And Jacob is a man we know already who is not afraid to deceive people to get his way. And he's a man who is willing to kind of do whatever it takes to make his way through the world, even if it means making a deal with God. And so he's like, all right, make a deal here with you, God. You keep my belly full, keep some clothes on my back, keep me safe, bring me back home when I'm done with this little hiatus, and tell you what, you get to be my God. Sweet, huh? Kind of like, you know, I'm the center of the universe and you get to be my God. Are you thrilled or what? And it kind of almost sounds like that, doesn't it? You get to be, you know, you'll be my God. And I tell you what, I'll even cut a deal with you. You give me all kinds of wonderful blessings. I'll only keep 90%. I'll give you 10. I'll give you a whopping 10%. You cannot turn that down, okay? Yeah, this is just Jacob being Jacob. But what Jacob doesn't know is he's on his way to his uncle's house. His uncle Laban, who is, by the way, cut from the same cloth. And when Jacob gets there, he's going to meet his match in Uncle Laban. Everybody needs an Uncle Laban to cut him down a notch or three. And that's Jacob is going to be there for 20 years, and he's going to live under the thumb of Uncle Laban. And Uncle Laban is going to allow Jacob to get a taste of his own medicine. And by the time 20 years passes, and Jacob begins to take his family, all of his children, and starts heading back to his homeland, Jacob is going to be a broken man. Jacob is going to be a man who is going to more readily recognize the provision of God in his life, the power of God in his life, the guidance and protection of God in his life. But there is going to be on that way home one final test of faith. And you guys remember the story. We'll get to it soon. Where Jacob is literally going to wrestle with God. Because all his life, that's what he's been doing. He's been wrestling with God. And this is kind of that part of that wrestling match. That kind of that making a deal with God. It's like, you know, God, put your arm down here. Let's just kind of see how strong you are, sort of a thing. And I tell you what I'll do. You make sure that I'm well taken care of, and I'll worship you, because obviously you need that sort of thing. And I'll give you 10% of everything you give me, and I think we'll have a pretty good relationship going on here. What do you think about that? You know? There will come a time, and Jacob will be an old man, but there will come a time when Jacob will say, it is him, it is God who has done everything in my life, who has given me everything in my life. It is God, it is God, it is God. It is none of me, it is all of God. And he will be a man who limps because he's wrestled with God all his life and he found out God's a little tougher than he thought. And he's going to find out you can't wrestle with God and win. You can't bargain with God and win. He's going to find out that God is a pretty tough person to bargain with. He's going to find out that God isn't interested in making deals. God is basically and ultimately going to communicate to Jacob in not so many words, listen, buddy, I don't need your 10%. By the time we're done, I'll have 100% of you. You will be mine. Body, soul, and spirit, you will be mine. And you will understand at that time that without me, you have nothing. And with me, you have everything. And I am the Lord of your life. I am the source of your life. I am the breath you breathe. I am your next heartbeat. I am all in all. And Jacob is going to come to terms with all of that. And he's going to get down on his knee one day and he's going to acknowledge the Lord God of the universe who is everything to him. But he's not there right now. He's bargaining. He's Jacob. He's the heel catcher. So this is just kind of where we are. We're a few years off from some of those lessons. Chapter 29, then Jacob continued on his journey. By the way, those of you who love literal translations of the Bible, some people do that. They'll come to me and they'll say, you know, I just really, Pastor Paul, I want a Bible that's the most word-for-word literal translation of the Bible I can get. And you know what I usually tell them? You wouldn't be able to understand it. Because it uses phrases and things that were common to those days, which you and I don't use. For example, this first verse, then Jacob continued on his journey. That's what it says in the NIV. I looked at it in some of the other modern translations. It's very, very similar. Do you know that in the Hebrew, it literally means he lifted up his feet. That's what it means. So if you want a literal word-for-word translation, which is impossible anyway, because it's just impossible to be perfectly literal. But if you want to try to get as literal as you can, you're going to read things like, then Jacob lifted up his feet and came to Padan Aram, or, you know, the house of his uncle or something. So I just kind of wanted to throw that out there. There's nothing wrong with modern translations because they help you and I speak in our local vernacular, and they help us to understand the Word of God. And the thing you need to understand about the languages that God chose for the Bible, in Hebrew and particularly Greek, He chose languages that the common man could understand. It was not scholarly languages that were used in the Bible. In fact, the Greek in the New Testament is what we call Koine Greek, and it was the kind of Greek that children would use playing in the street. Uneducated, small children. That's the language God chose for the Bible. So this idea that it has to be this flowery, scholarly sort of thing that sounds majestic, it's not the language God picked for the Scriptures. It just isn't. So if you want to make a big deal of it, that's fine, but I'm just telling you, you know, you're kind of dancing on the head of a pin. So anyway, so Jacob continued on his journey, that's the way you and I would say it, and came to the land of the eastern peoples. And there he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well, and the stone over the mouth of the well was large. Once again, in wells back in the Middle East, don't think of a well like you and I would think of a wishing well with a cute little roof, you know, and a bucket that you lower down and you throw coins in. Wells in those times were literally kind of like a crater almost. You would walk you would walk down to the mouth of the well and get your water, and then you'd walk kind of back up to level ground, and they often kind of came down like this, that's what a well looked, and it was usually huge, and in this case, they would cover the mouth of the well with a big stone that took a few people, apparently, to move. And it says in verse 4 that Jacob asked the shepherds who were sitting there by the well, apparently, he says, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yeah, we know him," they answered. And then Jacob asked, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep right now. And look," you know, Jacob's going to talk again. He's one of those guys, interesting guy. "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It's not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." Stop there. Jacob's kind of interesting. You know, he's already kind of getting involved in their business, you know. He comes along and he's going, "Guys, what are you doing sitting around the well? It's the middle of the day. You know, this isn't the time to just bring all the sheep in at the end of the day and water them. And if you're here to water them, great, water them and then get them back out to pasture. You got plenty of day left." So he's kind of questioning their shepherding tactics and procedures and so forth. And they respond to him and they say, "Well, you know, we can't water the sheep right now because the stone's too big and we have to wait for the other flocks to get here so the other shepherds can help us move the stone." Right? So, And then we'll water the sheep and so forth. And check this out. While they were still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Now, we get this a little later in the chapter, but we find out later in the chapter that, like many of the great women in the Bible, for some reason, this woman is just smoking hot, drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, she's just a sight to behold. In fact, it says she was lovely in form and beautiful. So she had the whole package. Anyway, you got to know that because that plays into what's about to happen here in the narrative. I think this is kind of funny. Well, it's kind of, yeah, anyway. So Rachel is coming with her father's sheep, and it says in verse 10, "Then Jacob," and this is important, "saw Rachel," okay? And he's kind of like, "Whoa. Daughter of Laban, his mother's brother and Laban's sheep," and he went over and single-handedly rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Now, this is great. This is like one of those, have you ever done that? I don't know, guys, maybe you've done this or not. I don't know. But it's like, "Oh, the stone, huh? I'll take care of that stone." I mean, you know, you see this gorgeous woman and he's like, "Boom, come and water the sheep." This guy is amazing. He just had this adrenaline rush when he looked at this gorgeous woman that caused him to just go and move the stone away. And I'm sure all these other shepherds are going, "Goodness gracious. What is up with him?" And then it gets better. It says in verse 11, "Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud." That's attractive. Right? I mean, now keep in mind, the kiss was a common Middle Eastern form of greeting. But a man wouldn't do that to a perfect stranger. That would have caught her off guard. You know, a man would kiss another man on the cheek and embrace him and greet him, particularly if they knew one another. But to walk up, I mean, he recognizes right now, he knows, she doesn't know yet, but he knows that she's a relative. And I think he's also pretty impressed with her. We know that. And so he walks up and plants a kiss on her and then starts to cry, you know? It's kind of like, dude, did you want to win this one or not, you know? But it's just kind of the way things go. Well, finally, you know, he kind of composes himself enough. In verse 12, it says he had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. And as soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. So this is his long-lost nephew, never met him before. And he embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. And then Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." After Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." And now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. And the name of the younger, we've already been introduced to, that's Rachel. And we're told that Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was, here it is, lovely in form and beautiful. All right? Now, it says that Leah, who was the older daughter, was weak in the eyes. It's interesting. If you have a different translation than the one I'm reading tonight, you may have a different wording there. It also says in some translations she had tender eyes, weak eyes. I've even heard compassionate eyes. But it would seem that what is being done here in this passage is we are making a comparative statement between these two sisters. We have no trouble understanding how they're describing Rachel. She's lovely in form and beautiful. So since they're making a comparative statement, we would assume that the statement is meant to kind of highlight the fact that Leah is just a fairly average-looking, you know, plain-looking woman, you know? Kind of that Sarah Plain and Tall kind of thing, if you guys remember that book or movie that went along with that. She's just kind of plain. Well, so it says in verse 18 that Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. And Laban said, well, I suppose it's better to give her to you than to some other man, so stay here with me. And so Jacob served 7 years. By the way, what a resounding encouragement from his future father-in-law to, you know, say, I'd like to work for your daughter. I'll work for 7 years. And he goes, well, I guess you're better than nothing. I mean, isn't that just encouraging? But anyway, I don't think Jacob even heard anything because he was so in love. It says, so Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him. Because of his love for her. You don't know what that's like? It's like he's just having so much fun. Just being around her. That 7 years goes by and it's like a few days to him just because he's just absolutely twitterpated with this woman. All right. Verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban, I wouldn't say this to a future father-in-law, but he said, give me my wife, my time is completed and I want to lie with her. I just personally wouldn't say that, but you know, being a dad who's married off a couple of girls, we just wouldn't want to hear that. But, so Laban brought together, now this is interesting, so Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah, wow, and gave her to Jacob. And because the women of that time wore a veil, and because she would have gone into the bridal chamber in the dark of night, Jacob was completely unaware that he had the older sister in the bridal chamber. And there you go. Laban pulls this thing off and Jacob lay with her, which basically was kind of the, you know, consummating thing of the marriage. And Laban, it says, gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. And when morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Laban replied, well, you know, it's not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Lame excuse, right? So he says, finish this daughter's bridal week, and then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. By the way, that doesn't mean he worked another 7 years waiting for Rachel. He just had to work. He just had to wait a week. They would have a bridal week, and after that week was over, Laban basically said, now we'll give you the younger daughter as well. So in a weird, sort of a strange way, now Jacob is being kind of almost forced into a bigamous relationship here. But you have to wonder as you read this narrative, how long it took for Jacob to kind of recognize the irony of this whole ordeal. I mean, think about it. Here he was being duped in much the same way that he had deceived his own father when it came to pronouncing the family blessing on him instead of his brother Esau. I mean, when you stop and think about it, in both cases, the concoction, or the deception rather, was concocted by the parent. That's the first thing. In both cases, the deception centered around passing someone off as someone else. Remember? And in both cases, the deception was set up to gain possession of something that was badly wanted. And in Laban's case, we know what Jacob wanted. He wanted the blessing that was he thought going to his brother. In Laban's case, he wanted more years of work out of Jacob. He was becoming himself wealthy because of Jacob's position there, because God was blessing Jacob. Laban was benefiting, and we'll read that in later chapters. He was becoming filthy rich, and he knew it was because of Jacob. So he wanted more time with him. He figured if he gave Rachel, he could just say, well, I fulfilled my contract. 7 years is up. I'm out of here, buddy. Arrivederci, sort of a thing, you know? So he's got to come up with some kind of a plan to keep Jacob here. And I think he also wants to marry off his older daughter, for whom apparently men weren't lining up at the tent door. So he figures he can kind of kill two birds with one stone, secure his own welfare, and hey, no problem. Either way, the deception worked. And although, you know, it worked, you can only imagine what the fallout must have been like after this single event. I mean, for 7 years, they'd all gotten along pretty well. But can you imagine what life was like after this? I mean, the relationship between Jacob and Laban had to have been absolutely shattered. I mean, where was the trust now that these men could even potentially regain? The relationship between Rachel and Leah is going to spiral from here on out. We don't know what their relationship was prior to Jacob coming. But we know from reading this passage, and we'll go through this, that their relationship is going to become one of competition and antagonism. And then, of course, the whole issue of the polygamous thing that Jacob is kind of thrown into is going to cause all of its own problems. And Jacob is going to suffer because of that as well. So the fallout from this is huge. It says in verse 29... that Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant, and Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. Take note of that. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. And so, can you imagine what life was like as Rachel, or as Leah rather? Can you imagine what that was like? You are forced into a marriage. I mean, she's just being obedient to her dad. And back in those days, women didn't have any choice. And her father probably came to her just before the couple was to go into their wedding chambers. Can you imagine what Rachel was thinking at this time? When her father comes to her and says, it's not your time yet tonight. And we don't know if he had to go lock her up. We don't know what he had to do to somehow get Rachel to go along with this. But to get Leah, to come to Leah and say to her, sweetie, tonight's the night. You're getting married tonight. Really, to who? To your sister's intended. So we're going to put a veil over you and maybe even dress you up a little bit like Rachel, maybe even use some of her perfume. And you're going to go into the wedding chamber and he's not going to know. But don't worry, it's all going to work out. Now listen, they've been there for 7 years with Jacob. She knows how Jacob feels about her sister. She knows. And to be thrust into a situation where you're so much property and forced into a relationship that is loveless. Well, we don't know how she felt about Jacob. We have no idea. But in those days, it wasn't all that important. A woman was told to marry whom her father directed her to marry. But we know one thing, and we saw it right here. Jacob did not love Leah. He did not love her. And so here's a woman who is married and unloved. And you guys know what that produces. You guys know that that's an unbearable situation for a woman. In fact, the Bible tells us it's an unbearable situation for a woman. Let me show you a passage from the Old Testament, from the book of Proverbs, chapter 30. Look at this. Under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up. That's poetic language to speak of an unbearable situation. First, a servant who becomes a king, a fool who is full of food, and look at number three, an unloved woman who is married. It is unbearable. Should it then be any surprise, men? And I'm talking to you now. Should it be any surprise, men, that in the New Testament, when God exhorts you about how to treat your wife in Ephesians, we'll look at this passage too. Right? It's not there. We're not going to look at this passage. Did I not put it on there? Well, let me give it to you. You ready, guys? Husbands, love your wives. Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives. Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. You know, he doesn't say, husbands, be sure you really buy a snazzy house for that little lady. Be sure she's always got the nicest clothes that money can buy. Husbands, be sure that she's always, you know, got plenty of friends around her and parties. And he doesn't say that. One thing. Husbands, love your wives. Husbands, make sure your wife knows beyond a shadow of a doubt you adore her. You love her. And you know what you have on your hands, guys? A happy woman. It's incredible to me over the years. I've seen women who have very little in terms of this world's wealth, and yet they have their husband's love. And they're happy ladies. By the same token, I've seen women who have a lot of what this world has to offer, but they are miserable in their marriage because they do not have a committed and loving husband. It's an unbearable situation for a woman. God created a woman to be loved by her man. And the love of a man does so much toward establishing and securing her emotional foundation. And that's why, ladies, when you have an issue come up between you and the man that God brought into your life, and it's an issue of conflict and problems, that's why life is not good for you. And life is not going to be good for you until you get that thing straightened out, until you get that thing resolved. And sometimes we guys, you know, we're clueless. We're like, we come home after having an argument in the morning and we've forgotten about it. We forgot it even happened. We went to work and had a good time. We went to, you know, because men are occupational. They go to work and they're like, yeah, boom. And then we come home and we go, hey, sweetie, what's for dinner? She's like, what? And she's still crying. And we're like, what? 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 What's up? And then she's got to sit us down and remind us about this morning. Remember you peeled out of the driveway because you were so mad and you slammed the door? Oh, yeah, forget it. I'm good. What's for dinner? And, you know, guys are just, they're ready to move on. But a woman can't move on until that thing's been settled, until it's been resolved, until you've sat down and talked it out. And I mean talked it out, till you're blue in the face, talked it out, sort of a thing, you know? That's okay. Love your wives as Christ loved the church. Yeah. Till you're blue in the face.